Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Site Side. This is Season 2. I'm James Hickey, founder of Pathways Collective and your host. I'm neurodivergent with autism and ADHD. I was identified in my 40s after spending most of my life being told I was unfocused, underperforming, and not living up to my potential. Turns out the problem all along was never about capability, it was about context, and that realization is a big part of what this show is built on with applied neurodivergence. So if you've been around for season one, welcome back. If you're new here, I'm glad you're here. I do want to take a moment and address the gap. I took a hiatus from the podcast to finish up my book. It's called Cyberspace Psychosis and the Virtual Reality Blues. The book is done, it's published, and it's available. I'm not going to get into it in this episode. I'm going to release an episode on Thursday, and we'll dig into the book a little bit, what it's about, why I wrote it, so stay tuned. Today's episode comes out of the Slowdown Summit in Columbus, Ohio. The Slowdown Summit was a leadership conference built specifically for introverts and neurodivergent leaders. It's a different pace, a different format, totally different energy from the usual conference circuit, and it's where I met today's guest, Teresa Falk. Teresa is an educator working directly with neurodivergent students. She was a speaker at the summit, and the conversation we had there was the kind that makes you want to keep talking. So we did, and that's what you're about to hear. One quick disclaimer before we dive into it today. We had a couple technical issues during the recording. Teresa's audio comes through loud and clear. We don't have a problem there. Mine was much quieter than it should be, and I want to apologize for that. I had considered re-recording, but the conversation we had was just too good to lose. So we're just going to roll with it. The show transcript is going to be available on some of the platforms out there. If you can't find it on your podcast, whatever you listen on to your podcast on, I'm going to throw a copy of it on the website with the show notes. So if you need to follow along that way, go ahead and download it. Anyway, let's get into it. Here's the conversation with Teresa Falk. Okay. Hey, Teresa, welcome to the show. I want to thank you for coming on the Site Side. This is our inaugural reintroduction episode. I took a little bit of a hiatus, so you're going to be we're launching season two with this. So let's just jump into it. All right, Miss Teresa, do you want to go ahead and give our audience maybe a little bit about who you are, your background, and we could start from there.
Sure. My name is Teresa Falk, and I am a veteran educator. I've been in the classroom for 31 years as of this year. I have taught sixth grade through college, mostly 7th and 8th grade and high school. I teach English, women's studies. I've taught theater. I am a performer and a writer, a poet, and a creative in all kinds of ways. And just really, I think, this is the way I like to think about it. My job is a teacher. My career is education, but my life path is in healing. And so everything that I do really ties back to that. And in a lot of ways, it kind of connects to what we're going to be talking about today. And so 31 years in education, and I'm still going strong.
Okay, that's, I absolutely love it. We are focused on neurodivergence in the workplace, generally. So we either have neurodivergent guests or neurodivergent adjacent to guests such as yourself. And from our brief introduction last week, we really got into a little bit about your approach to neurodiversity in the classroom. So I want to hear a little bit about that path, like how you started working with neurodiverse students, maybe your first introduction to it, and really how that has, evolved over a 31-year career. I mean, it's pretty impressive. I'm very interested to hear some of that.
There are two basic branches on this, and one is personal and one is professional. So professionally, the idea of neurodiversity, or even the words, the language, the vocabulary, really, in a lot of ways, hasn't been common in the field of education, at least for me, until maybe, 10 years ago. And I think it's not something that fell into my lap as neurodiversity. It fell into my lap as certain students who very obviously had difficulties and learning disorders and attention issues, and quite honestly, just problems figuring out the rhythm of education. and how to survive in a classroom. And so on that side of it, you know, I've always been one who, for whom I teach a child and not a subject. So I'll teach them to write, all of that, but I'm about the child. And so because I connect well with students, you know, I can tell who's having issues in my class. And so often my path to discovering their neurodiversity was through conversation, and often not through those vocabulary words. I just knew that there were certain kids that really were slow readers or had a hard time focusing in the classroom or just thought in ways that were different from the other students. And often in wonderful ways, as you probably know, the neurodivergent student is incredibly brilliant and focused, and you know, they have superpowers above and beyond and in different ways. I think maybe that's a controversial way to say it as well. But you know, for me, it was always about focusing on those things. And then about 5 years ago, when the vocabulary really started coming into the workplace and the places that I worked, it was a little bit easier to say, okay, so this is the lens through which we're working. And so I started doing that. The honest answer to the other branch of this is really important, and that is I have a neurodivergent child. So I have a 13-year-old son, and he is dyslexic and ADHD. He also suffers from anxiety and PTSD. You know, he's got a lot of letters and he's had a lot of experience. So when he started having issues in school and he was diagnosed with all of these issues, of course, as a mother, I went super, super focused on it and read all the books and talked to all the people and the rest of it. And being a teacher, those two branches met up. And I am a better teacher because I am a mother to a neurodiverse child. And I feel in some ways I'm a better mom because I am teacher to neurodiverse people. So that's how all of that kind of got started. And so I became in my workplace a little bit of an expert on neurodiversity, not academically, but experientially. And honestly, that's better than any book. Better than any book. So that's where all of these things kind of came together.
Right. Oh, that's really, you know, it's I move more and more into neurodivergent space. I find that a lot of our allies and neurodiverse adjacent people who aren't necessarily on the spectrum or exhibit neurodiverse characteristics themselves are many of them what we call someone who has skin in the game. For example, like they have a child who's, you know, autistic child, or they have a sibling, or someone who's come up with a personal, you know, very personal relationship with neurodiversity in some, you know, some capacity. So that's really amazing that you were able to move those lessons, not only from your child, but also, you know, put that into the classroom. I did want to circle back to something you said earlier about, you know, neurodiversity, not necessarily with like superpowers, but with very, very unique cognition. We all have a different way that we're going to process information, that we're going to communicate information and learn. How would you reconcile that as a teacher, where you have someone who has a very, very unique, one-of-a-kind approach to how they, you know, take in information? Meanwhile, you're also trying to take care of 29 other kids and then keep everything on track for a state-imposed curriculum. Like, how do you, I mean, it seems like a lot of plates that you're, you know, balancing all at once. How do you reconcile all of that?
I have two answers to that. One, I have, my career has been in the private schools, to be clear. So what's interesting about that is that the private schools don't have, and I mean this in general and not necessarily my school, but private schools don't have any legal responsibility toward neurodiversity or learning plans. And so, and on the other side of that, you know, my classes are no bigger than 16. I'm super lucky in that way. However, I will also say that for the original question, how do I juggle all of that? That's my job. I don't think all students believe, student, excuse me, I don't think all teachers feel that. And that's not a criticism. I think that's more of a statement about misunderstanding about what neurodiversity is. But the moment I became a teacher, I dedicated my life to each student and their individual ways of learning. My job, my task, my life path is to help those students learn and grow. And in order to do that, you do what you have to do. Has it been easy? Not necessarily, especially in the early days when I had students that, you know, for instance, had dyslexia or ADHD. I've had students with Tourette's. I've had students with ODD. I've had students with a lot of things. But it's just knowing, it's just doing the planning. And then early on, it's totally experiential. It's like, well, how's this going to work? Okay. And this was before audiobooks, right? Really, for instance, when I first started teaching in the early 90s, we didn't even have that. So if I had students that had difficulty reading, it was about spending time with them. It was about printing their handouts with bigger font. It was about sitting with them after school and reading things out loud to them. And then, of course, you know, bringing in their parents and bringing in any other support that we could do. So how do I juggle it? I just do. And I think responsible educators do it. And that's a big statement, I know. And there are going to be people who, you know, have hit that. But you know what? I've done it for 31 years. I know what I'm talking about. And I think that once you come to understand a student and their needs, whether they're neurodiverse or not, it becomes a little bit better. As in the past few years, especially in the past 5 years in my particular workplace, we have moved forward with with very specific plans. We have we call it ARC, Academic Resource Center. We have learning support specialists. It is new, it is growing, but and you know, we need to expand, but we have that. And so now with the support and now with the acknowledgement, honestly, the biggest thing is the acknowledgement of the vocabulary, is the acknowledgement of the presence of these students. One of the best things ever to happen to me as an educator, get all emotional now. Is a student that I had a few years ago. His name is Kainoa. He is now in college. But when I had him as an eighth grader, he spoke to me about his neurodiversity and his dyslexia. And, you know, he's a smart kid and he was an amazing student, pushed through. And he asked me at one point, because I had been helping him, he said, Mrs. Falk, would you be willing to do a club for neurodiversity? I'm like, yes, absolutely, let's do it. And so we formed together with him at the helm, our Einstein and Spielberg Club. And basically it just started out as, you know, if you're neurodiverse and you want community, come on down. And it was great because, you know, in my head, at first, I was like, okay, what are we going to do? You know, what social justice movements are we going to push today, right? Because that's who I am.
Right.
But you know what was beautiful about it is just students would come in our first meeting, we had 20 students. You know, many of them undiagnosed or self-diagnosed, who said, I'm being very honest here, who said, oh, I know that I have something, but my parents are afraid to get me tested because they don't want a label associated with me. And so, you know, and that's hard because that means they're going without supports or whatever, but they knew enough to come to the meeting and, you know, and hang out. And these meetings were wonderful because we did everything from, you know, how do we educate our faculty and staff, to, you know, helping one another with hints and tricks to help, you know, help their progress. And some days it's so great. I got to tell you, James, my favorite meetings were when they just came in and completely unmasked. So like we would, they would just, we had this thing where they would come in and do, they would do presentations. They would just make the slide deck and do presentations and info dump on the things that they love. And they were the, they were awesome. Like I had a kid come in and just info dump on her love of To Kill a Mockingbird. Like just, you know, and everything about it and the actors and the books and everything else. Or they talk about Minecraft or they talk about whatever. And so what it became was a safe space and a place to unmask, because many of these kids, you know, whether or not we're talking about, you know, ADHD or anxiety or what have you, or mental health, right? They would come in and just exhale. And for me as an educator, that's kind of the first step to being able to work with them in a classroom. If you don't provide a safe space, and I'm talking, you know, they're different kind of nested levels of institutions, right? You have the world, you have your community, you have your school, and then you have your classroom. Like you have to provide the safety on all those levels, or, you know, just telling them to read an audiobook makes no sense.
Right.
Doesn't do anything, you know? So like, I, you know, in answer to your question, I just do it. I juggle it. I learn, I try to be vocal with, I don't even try. I am very vocal with my administration and my fellow colleagues about my students and, you know, how we can help. So
that is,
believe me, the answer to that question could take 2 hours.
Yeah,
so I just gave you the bit.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. I mean, I think you're doing some great initiatives, especially like starting a club, like fellowshipping is so important and so many, especially with these kids. I mean, what a wonderful like environment for them to thrive in. Knowing that they're not alone on the path, that's something that I feel a lot of late diagnosed adults, such as myself. Like I wasn't diagnosed until I was 45 years old. And that's a long chunk of time. So over 4 decades of, you know, mid to high functioning, high masking survival. And there wasn't any kind of, you know, structure. And I'm not the only one. There's, you know, thousands of us who are coming to terms with this in later in life, coming to a, you know, diagnosis and looking back on everything through the lens of neurodivergence. And we realize, oh, that's why. Okay, that's why.
Oh,
that's what it is. It's it's a wake up call because it does provide clarity, especially for moving forward. You know, it's like, you know, we joke around how being undiagnosed means that you're, you know, you've been playing a video game on hard mode while everyone else is on easy mode, except you don't know why. Getting the diagnosis realizes that you've been playing on hard mode. You realize what it is. And that's pretty much it. You just, you know, you can strategize a little bit better, but besides that, it's still is what it is. And I remember, like, you know, being in school when I was younger, I always wondered, like, why it seemed like all my peers, everyone around me, like, they received the guidebook on how to live life, you know, and I must have missed that memo because I had no idea how to human, basically. And it didn't help that I didn't have the support at home. Like, I literally grew up under siege. So it's like this, you know, 1-2 punch of, you know, trying to make our way through the world. So it really warms my heart to hear that you're taking this initiative to give these kids a safe space. Because again, that fellowship, it's just so important to, you know, realize that they're, you know, they're making friends with each other. They can unmask. They're in a place where they can be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's beautiful.
Those meetings, you know, and it is kind of, it's kind of funny because those meetings sometimes are few and far between because, you know, with neurodiverse students, you know, sometimes I did have to nudge and go, hey, do we want a meeting? Oh yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah. Like, okay. So here are the 3 things you need to do. Can we do that? Can I help you with that? Like, you know, in other words, like in a weird way, even putting meetings together and organizing, you know, was kind of practice for the world in that way. And as for neurodiversity and myself, it's so interesting. So I'm 57 and I have never identified as neurodiverse. But since I started learning about ADHD in particular, and doing the study and looking at the way it presents in girls and women, lately I've kind of gone, whoa, this sounds a little bit familiar to me. And I can't tell. I mean, it's a joke, but not a joke. Couldn't tell whether it was like menopause or COVID or this or
A
neurodiversity
combination. Could be all of the
combination.
above, right?
Could be all of the above. But I think, and everybody's on a spectrum for that, obviously. But I think, and sometimes when I talk about neurodiversity, I'll have friends or colleagues who will very well-meaningly say, well, everybody's ADHD these
That's
days,
such a
which,
that's one of the that's actually one of the things that motivated me to write my latest book of cyberspace psychosis about so after I was diagnosed, someone said, oh, well, everyone's a little autistic. And I'm like, no, you're not. Everyone has artificially induced neurodivergence just from our exposure to technology. Like, we get these people are rewiring their brains literally to seek dopamine while they're doom scrolling. They get that slot machine effect. So
Oh
it
God,
is
I have
art, right?
teenagers, I know.
Right. It's like they're chasing that dose. So it's like they're, and that will give ADHD symptoms. It might give a state of neurodivergence, but it's not necessarily the same as a condition. A state is temporary, it could go away. Someone with a condition, though, you're not going to be able to, you can't unplug and turn off the screen and suddenly not be autistic anymore. It doesn't work like that.
And
So
that's, yeah.
it's wild because I see this a lot in society. I don't want to go on a rant about artificially induced neurodivergence, but it is funny that you mentioned it because it's like really it is technology does play a role in that. One of the things I did want to ask you about, just being classroom culture and going through this, you mentioned a couple moments that really stick with you. You mentioned the one gentleman who had you start the club and get involved with that. Can you think of any moments where maybe a student was struggling, like to pick something up or learn a, learn something basic that maybe their peers in the classroom were able to pick up a little easily? Could you think of any moments where they kind of had that light bulb pop on, where suddenly they got it, like everything clicked in?
I'm going to say that on the one hand, I get if you're an educator, you see, hopefully, you see 10 of those a day in small little bits. There's not one moment, I think, where, especially with neurodivergence that I have experienced, where someone has just gone, oh my God, I get it now, right? Because that's also not the way we learn. Like, I don't know a lot about neurobiology, but like, I don't think also that that's the way our brains learn. So the things that I've experienced with my neurodivergent students aren't necessarily these big aha moments. They are these small ones that lead up over time. So I can tell you about, I mean, I always go back to Kainoa. I can't wait for him to hear this. Because what I watched through him is little bits. Watching him, and it's not just light bulbs, it's procedure, and it's watching him be able to ask for help and advocate for himself. Because quite frankly, for my neurodivergent students, like that's the biggest thing, and my kid, it's learning to advocate to say, this is what I need. And so, being with Kainoa both as a teacher and then later, because I taught him twice actually, as an eighth grader and as a senior, which is really cool. And then as an advisor, watching him become more confident in just the w organizing himself and, writing emails and doing all of those things. I think one thing that did happen that really, like, if I had a cry moment with him, it was the fact that when he emailed me things to ask to have a meeting or to ask for instance, guest speakers, because in our club, one of the things that, you know, we did was bring in our guest speakers, and one of which was our wonderful college counseling director to come talk about, you know, college admissions and all that. I said, okay, I'll write the email. And he goes, no, I'll do it. I'll do it. And so he wrote this email. And the thing is, I get 10 emails a day from students. Many of them are like, Miss Falk, could I have this? Okay, bye. Or bro, or whatever. That's what happens, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, looking at their grammar and all of that. He wrote perfect emails that were articulate and succinct and thoughtful and intentional. And I know for a fact that it took him a long time to do it. And that is the one thing, you know, when I think about him and all of my other neurodivergent students mirrored, what people do not understand, and sometimes what educators themselves don't understand, and this isn't a criticism, it's an observation, is exactly how much work a neurodivergent student does to do what everybody else does. Like you were talking about with the video game, you're on like supreme hard mode all the time. Yes. And what that does, I mean, even for my own child with math, for instance, like he's doing math, but everything now is word problems. And sometimes his teachers are like, what's wrong with him? How come he can't? And I'll say, because he's spending all of his time decoding the words, he has no energy left to actually do the math.
That language is bothering when someone's like, what's wrong with you? And it makes it seem like there's a defect, and it's not. It's not necessarily, I mean, no one asked for this. Like, do you think no one woke up and they're like, oh, I want to be autistic, or I want to be, you know, no one asked. It's like a mental illness, you know, same thing. Like, no one asked for that. It just is. And it's not necessarily a, you know, something that's wrong. So it's, you know, it's when I hear that, if they say that to a student or even to a parent, you're going to wonder, like, well, is my kid defective? Is there anything, you know, wrong with it? And it's not a, I don't think it's a healthy, I mean, this is one of the things that I, you know, hope that your message is going to go out and reach other educators and realize that, yeah, it's not the way that you phrase things to people, not you personally, but just like, you know, in general, can be useful. You know, if you're like, oh, well, what's wrong with you? No, how about, you know, because that implies that, you know, defection. It implies that we're, you know, less than, and it's not, you know, so it's not healthy.
I'm just going to say it. My son had a teacher who told him that audio books do not count as reading and would not give him accommodations. And it just in general made him feel stupid and less than. And I'll just say it too. We took him out of that private school and put him in a public middle school here, and he is doing so much better because that's the thing, at least in the public sector, you know, because there's a legal responsibility, right? They have to learn vocabulary and they have to be able to meet needs. Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah, I remember you said that at the start, that the private schools have no, you know, legal obligation. Whereas a student who goes into a public school, if it's getting public funds and they have a, you know, formal diagnosis, you know, they're required to be accommodated. That's just wild to me that the private sector isn't required to. It's interesting.
Things become buzzy. Okay, they become buzzwords, and so for a little while, and I think it's still in the room, you know, neurodiversity is a buzzword. And then, you know, this is the thing that all of the teachers get training on or want training on, you know, and then AI is the new buzzword, right? So, you know, I hate that it's a buzzword because that kind of implicates that, like, it's going to go away. But I don't think it will, because what I do see is this generation. You know, I'll take all of my Einstein and Spielberg kids who now have an identity, know who they are, some of them anyway, actively claiming their neurodiversity as this thing, you know. And they're the ones that are going to be going into the workplace. They're going to be the ones that go into education. And because of that, and because they're of their safety with their identity on that, will be, believe me, this generation is going to demand recognition. It's thrilling whenever, because again, I've been doing this 31 years. So I have, I think the number's more than now, but I have 21 or 22 former students who are my colleagues and administrators.
They got my school. Education themselves?
Yep. Okay. And I watch them. And so, you know, neurodiverse or not, like this generation, this is a generation. Everybody says, oh, this generation, that's what we do for all of them, right? But, oh, don't even mess with Gen Z. Because, and of course, everyone's going to go, oh, well, they're this and they're that and they're about TikTok. Like, yeah, they're also about figuring out who they are and demanding agency.
I love that. It's something that is really kind of taking, I see that in the culture of workplaces everywhere. Once Gen Z hits the workforce, like, because there's a lot of a pushback to Gen Z won't generally give a 2-week notice before leaving a job. And they get blasted for being like, they're like, oh, you're unprofessional. And the Gen Z is like, well, would you give me a 2-week notice before firing me? No. You know, it's like one of those, you know, it's like, and it's interesting how, and it's just like one sense of mindset. So I feel like Gen Z is coming into a world where they're, demanding a recognition, and they realize they don't just want to be a cog, you know, cog in a machine and just put their face, you know, their head down and take it. So it's really interesting that they're, you know, that you mentioned that, especially about the generational thing, which is wild because Gen Z is the first generation that's been born into the digital world.
Yeah.
You know, they've never known a world without internet, which is why it's like, I can't even imagine that. So it's like they're born into it. And I see it with, I see it with my children, how they're a lot more digitally dependent. And it's really, I see in some ways it's a little bit better because they have access to things like my daughter was working on a research paper, and she was like, she's able to find her sources. And I'm trying to tell her, I'm like, well, Bat, you know, we had to go to find a card catalog. You know, we had to go to the actual library, you know, like do all these things. She's like, Daddy, you're old. I'm like, I know, it's wild, but it's, you know, cause it's, you know, things have changed. I did want to touch on that. So I just did some quick math. You got into education in 1995.
I did take a year off. And so I started teaching at the high school level and middle school level in 1993.
Okay.
So we'll go back.
That's wild. I was a class of 1998. Okay. So I was undiagnosed through elementary school, middle school, high school, of course. ADHD was known, but it wasn't necessarily widely diagnosed. And there weren't a whole lot of treatments for it. There was, I think Ritalin was the only one available. And I, you know, and I had, you know, struggled with paying attention, all these different things. And it was, one of my biggest struggles was everything was so mind-numbling boring. Like my biggest pet peeve, and this is like such a, I don't know if this is like laziness or it's just like standard, is when they would go around the class and have people take turns reading the book, you know, reading out of the textbook out loud. And I'm like, this is, you know, we were supposed to do that. It was our assignment. We read it. Why are we spending time on this? But it was just so mind-numbingly boring because, you know, as someone with ADHD, naturally we could process information very quickly. So we could read quickly. And then it's like, why are we, you know, it seemed like it was slowing everything down. As this progressed, when I would get older, I would, I'd bring my own stimulation into class. I would read books. Like I'd be reading my own. I remember I got into one with an English teacher because we were doing a Scarlet Letter, which I had absolutely no interest in. Meanwhile, I brought in my own, I was reading Thuvia Made of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which is one of the it's the stories that would put, you know, it's like a real romance book. You know, this is the kind of story that really gets, you know, people, you know, going. It'll put hair on your chest. You know, those are the things that young men need to be reading. And so I was in there and I got it because I'm like, you know, reading my own. She's like, well, this is an American class. I'm like, I don't care. That's boring. No one wants, you know, there's no way that, you know, being a teenager in the late 20th century is going to relate to some of the stuff they would have us read. You know, like Ethan Frome. What the? Seriously? Silas Marner, who's going to read this shit? Like, how is like, you know, we're on the cusp of the millennium, and you're having us read these things. And I look at many people in my generation, and no one likes to read. And I wonder why, because they make it terrible. They make it so so terrible with it. And it was so anyway, I would bring in my own stimulation just so I would try to just get through the day. Otherwise, I'd be like, you know, bouncing. I'd be like really, you know, just overwhelmed with the boredom. And I wanted to ask, do you ever, like, because I know that's an ADHD, you know, symptom and side effect. How do you address that in the classroom?
Okay, so I have been doing this specifically in the past couple of years, and I really had to change my mindset, because as a teacher, you've been trained that the kids should look you in the eye, that the kids should be focused for, you know, 55 minutes sitting in a chair, which is like completely unhealthy for any human being, right? So I do a few things. One, I always give breaks, always. Like, they're never doing any one thing for 20 minutes. Two, I make it clear in my classroom that if you need to get up and move, you get up and move. So, you know, I have students sometimes that will just, you know, stand up. The chairs have wheels in our classroom. And it's funny because on the one hand, some teachers are like, God, this is the worst thing ever. And I'm like, no, it's the best, right? But okay, so my favorite story, there are a couple of things. Oh my God, there's so much. So in terms of, I mean, I bring in fidgets. I let them have fidgets. By the way, they're trends. Everybody likes the butter ones now and the corn. It's hilarious. It's like little sticks of butter that you can, you know. And in the past, I'd be like, no, you can't be doing that, because that's how I was trained, right? Now I find that it works really well. So here's my mini story that's one of my favorite ever. So I was in a classroom, and these, you know, I always give a 3-minute break. And I used to be in a classroom where right outside the door, there was kind of a circular hallway, you know, it was the building. And I'd say, okay, you guys, take a lap. That was the joke. And they would take me seriously, and they would get out a snack. They'd walk, sometimes arm in arm, which made my, or they'd skip, or they'd like crab walk.
Right.
Like, around. I also have always puzzles and Legos and magnetite, like I have stuff. And sometimes it was quite gendered, like the boys would always, you know, go for the Legos and the girls would go for the puzzles or whatever. But that classroom overlooked our football field and track. And so I said, okay, 3 minutes. And one day one of my girls was like, it's all, I'm like, yeah. She goes, the boys are running around the track. And I went, what? So I go to the window, and there's 5 8th grade boys, and they're just tanking it. They're sprinting around the track. And we're going, wow, they took me seriously when I said, take a lap. So they come back in. They are sweaty. They are laughing. They are breathing. And they are calm. And that particular group of boys had a presentation right after that. And it was one of the best presentations of the day. And it's what taught me that, nope, you have to have movement. And, you know, were they sweaty and stinky? Yes, that's okay. They're middle schoolers. It happens. But it made them focus. And over the years since that, like, I've had students tell me that 3-minute break is literally the best moment of their day in the school day, which really, you know.
Do they get a recess, or is this like, is this older past?
It's eighth grade, and they get a little bit of a recess, but, you know, 55 minutes, because my school is an extremely academic, rigorous institution. Okay. This is, you know, there's a lot. These kids have hours of homework a night. And so even within that 55 minutes, I found if you don't give them a brain break, and some kids will move, some kids lie on the floor. And then I used to be like, no, you can't do that, or you can't be on your iPads. And just lately, I've undone that, because for some kids, it's playing chess for 3 minutes on their screens. For some kids, it's putting their head down. For some kids, it's running around the track. But if you don't let them unmask and rest and recharge, then they don't work. And so, you know, when we talk about, particularly with ADHD, that's one of the things that's worked the best, is just plain old acknowledgement and movement. And, you know, just knowing that a kid is going to need, you know, and I have kids now because I'm also very proud that a lot of kids will advocate and say, Mrs. Volk, I really need to move. I'm like, okay, do it. Go for it. Right. Or if I can notice that a kid, because I know what to look for, notice the kid said, like, do you need to move? Do you need to stand? Do you need water? I think you need something. And they'll be like, yeah, I think I do. I'm like, great. Do it. Come on back when you're ready. I find in my middle school classroom, group work is a complete, you'd think that this would be like, oh yeah, group work, they're happy, you know? But that is draining for a kid that has neurodiversity in some way. Kind of like the speech that I did for Slowdown Summit, like, you know, the kid who will be spending all the time trying to decode the notes, or has or wants to take notes and has dysgraphia, or just has talked for 10 whole minutes to a group of kids they may not get along with, and they're exhausted afterward. And so as I grow in my career, because I'm still growing and will continue to grow every right. moment, I'm learning to find the triggers for kids and to pay attention and to notice when they need something. Because if you don't provide a safe space, if you don't pay attention to the whole child, they're not going to learn anything. So in my opinion, this is what all teachers should be doing. And, you know, is it hard? Yes. Do you need training? I think so. You know, I don't have official training, but I have a kid, right? And I have experience. That's a long-winded way of saying all of that.
So let me ask you, what would that look like for you? Like if you were mm-hmm. in, if you were going to put together like a CEU course or something for teachers and your peers to kind of bring them up to speed on introducing some of these holistic points of view into their classroom with an eye on neurodivergence. Like, what would you, you know, that's interesting that you brought that up, but I want to kind of unpack that a little bit. What would a course like that look like?
That's great. Cause I have been thinking about that and now maybe I'll just put something together. I think first of all, the first level is education. And this is not, I mean, when we talk about a course, by the way, educating teachers and asking teachers to learn is like the hardest thing in the world. And anybody can challenge me on that because it's true, because we all think we know what we're doing, right? Because that's what we do. But one, education on vocabulary and what neurodiversity is. I would also ideally, like if I could do it in person and by panel. My dream has always been to have some of the neurodiverse students that I teach be comfortable enough to sit in front of our faculty and say, hey, I'm here. I exist. This is what a day is for me. This is what something looks like for me. And then, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are experts, right? But what I've learned as an educator is allowing teachers and administration to talk to one another about and unpack their experiences. And then, you know, with a little bit of guidance from an expert is ideal. You cannot just say, here is the expert from XYZ who's going to come in and tell you how to do it. We need strategies, but we also need community. I think I'm going to go back to that, is the idea of having our educators be comfortable as a community within their respective schools and to be comfortable enough to talk about not only I'm willing to do it, but to have to be able to mediate and be honest enough to say, I don't know what to do, or I don't agree with XYZ, right? So it needs to be, I've always told my students when we talk about social change, that you have to go from two directions. You have to go from the top down and the bottom up. You know, you have to go from the individual, right? And then you, but you also have to have administration say, yes, this is what we are supporting and this is what you're expected to do. Like, not in the sense of, you know, throwing down the, you have to do this, right? But throwing down the expectation that this is who we are as a community. Not we're forcing you to, but having the idea of neurodiversity be part of that, that bigger sense of social justice and equity that right. every school should be putting forth.
I think that's
because
it's important. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like touching on that, you had a, I wanted to get a little bit of your vision for what you see, like structure support for neurodiverse students once they graduate. And what you had talked about being like part of the broader community. And I feel that it's important to make sure that they're not, you know, like sequestered in a separate classroom or kept separate. Because there's a lot of real world, you know, real world situations that a lot of kids are, you know, they're going to have to deal with once they get out of that. I don't want to say bubble of, you know, the school system, but it kind of is. Like, once you're in the real world, and we see some incidents with like higher needs neurodiverse kids who are might act up violently or have different, you know, a certain disposition that falls under a behavior plan within the, you know, purview of the school system. Once they graduate and they're 18 and they flip out and punch someone in line at, you know, Starbucks, then there's real world consequences. Then they're under arrest. Then it's like they're facing real, you know, actual legal trouble. That can't just be explained away. So what would you see? And this, I'm like, again, that's just like a, you know, severe example, but what would you like to see in place as far as like support or structure or any type of transitioning from classroom to the real world?
Oh, gosh. Thanks so much. I will say that depending on the school, college counseling, especially in the private schools, right? Because private schools pride themselves on being able to prepare students for college and all of that. College counseling should, I think, be very specific in their guidelines for helping students with this. I know that my school's really, you know, I think we're just getting started, but you know, we had our college counselor come talk to our club about. Here are schools, for instance, like Landmark College and, you know, other colleges that are focused specifically, you know, on neurodiversity. So those things do exist. I think also that, I mean, the supports can't come from one place. They have to grow from within the community. And I think that the neurodiverse community and Gen Z, I'm telling you, they're going to do it themselves. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, because I know that's something that people are trying to work on, because this idea that we have these cookie cutter jobs that exist and we have to prepare neurodiverse students to be able to go to, that is not a thing anymore. Because as we know, you know, our kids are going to go, they're already going into jobs that didn't exist 5 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, as Millie Tommy talked about, you know, with Generalist World,
right.
That, you know, in 5 years, in 4 years, our kid, again, students are going to go into even more jobs that don't exist. AI, right? Taking over certain kinds of positions.
It's a credential crisis. Like,
Gen Z is going to have to create its own world. Right. That is another thing when I think about these really amazing generation. And so when we look even more narrowly at neurodiversity, I think what I see happening is people looking at their skills and figuring out, well, what can I do? maybe I'll do this, and then they make it happen, right? I would love to see organizations that kind of help build that thread for neurodiverse young people. I also think policy within organizations that push attention toward neurodiversity. I think like the changing way of what a workplace looks like, for instance, right? And, you know, looking at it in that way. I also think, like, I have this image in my head. I'm an English teacher, so I see images and metaphors. Like, this generation is having to dig itself out of holes that, like, you know, COVID, huge hole, neurodiversity, AI, like, they're being, society in general, like, they just are being, like everywhere they go, they fall into a hole, and then they have to get themselves out of it. And so, you know, I think that the approach to transitioning students to, you know, quote unquote, the real world, which I think is very funny because school is the real world. I hate that phrase. I gotta say that, like, because they're like, well, you get into the real world. And that's what a lot of, I think, people in education sometimes say is that, well, you're not going to get time and a half on the report that you have to write in the real world. It's like, well, that's actually, I mean, yes, and, you know, it's about encouraging and talking about it so that our you know, our companies and organizations think about how to use the specific skills of neurodivergent people. And quite frankly, I think it's just make the noise. We need to make the noise. Because it's the big organizations led by a generation, and I'm going to say I'm Gen X, so I'm probably part of that generation. Although I do think Gen X and Gen Z are kind of similar, like I claim that. But I think that they're going to have to make their own roads on this, because the institutions and the ideas that are in place are in very traditional workplaces. They're archaic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, and that's going to be more than, hey, listen to this podcast it's by this person.
You know, it's funny because we circled back to like your this concept of organic growth. And I love what you're saying about Gen Z is really going to be, you know, on the forefront of this, I would say, like, revolution almost of, like, you know, accepting neurodivergence in, you know, the workplace, in, you know, just in day-to-day life. But right now, it's like we touched on earlier in the podcast that anyone who is a supporter has skin in the game. Like, you have someone in a leadership in a company, they're only going to, you know, want to accommodate neurodiversity because they have like a kid who's neurodiverse, or they have like a, if they have actual personal relationship with it. For everything else, it's just really, really slow going. It's like trying to turn a battleship, you know, we're trying to get the, you know, make this massive, massive turn. And there's just so much of this institutional inertia that was left behind from, you know, we all say it, the boomer generation, you know, older Gen X, whatever you want to look at, you know, these archaic, more traditionalist states of mind and systems that are, you know, in place. And those traditional pipelines just don't cut it anymore. You know, we talk about AI, and we're really at the cusp of it, where AI is, companies are laying off people to literally bring in AI and agentics, and people are being, you know, we are in a credential crisis. Like, we're at a point where, like, credentials for different, whatever, you know, specialized little niche areas of knowledge aren't as asymmetrical as they used to be. You know, things are very, very, you know, we have access to everything now. So it's very, you know, it's interesting how, like, the playing field for knowledge and being able to access knowledge is leveling out. And the people in the future are the ones who are going to be able to best leverage that. You know, being able to, you know, you have a Gen Z person who's grown up using AI. and having an interface with it and establishing a rapport with it versus someone from an older generation who is treating it like a you know, like an adversary or like a you know, like a search engine. And they're not seeing it for the tool that it is. They claim it's, you know, they'll look at it with a sense of suspicion or you know, just generally suspicion. They don't want to accept any new technologies versus someone who's born into a technological age. So I feel like as all of this starts to come up, we're going to start to see things, you know, start to see some things popping. You know, there's a lot of, you know, I know in the neurodivergent community, there's a lot of different projects that are taking place nationwide as far as, you know, providing alternative hiring pipelines, for example. Some that provide, you know, they'll, because a lot of people who are on the spectrum, they might not necessarily have the patience to handle the level of bureaucracy that it takes to get a job, because you have to, they're not going to sit through five interviews and fill out form after form after form and do all these, you know, go through all these qualifiers. And no one has, I mean, neurotypicals barely have the attention span for that. Or the bandwidth for that. Meanwhile, you get some things on the spectrum and they're going to be like, no, I'm done. You know, I'm not going to mess with this. So, you know, we have these, they're providing alternative hiring pipelines. There's projects that are looking at alternative housing. So there's different things that are starting to, you know, we're starting to see some progress. I don't necessarily, I feel like the need for it really outweighs the supply right now. But we're getting, you know, we're starting to get there. We're starting to get, starting to see some, you know, the tide's turning and it's
something that, something that you said really struck me. And that is the idea of knowledge, because I think one of the things that is happening with the onset of AI and is that what is knowledge, right? And how do we, what does that even mean? If we have AI that can throw you, you know, an entire 100-page research paper in a matter of minutes, then what does knowledge mean? And is it information? And where does knowledge sit? I think this might get a little woo-woo, but this is what I really believe. I think it's part of the problem is that we think knowledge lies in words and in the brain, where knowledge, I think, also lies in instinct. It's very old, I think, in instinct and perception and spirit. Right. And which, if you look at certain kinds of neurodiversity, is exactly where the strengths lie. In connection, in perception, in understanding, and in empathy, which are elements that, quite frankly, and yes, I'm going to go here, those are gendered, right? And then you look at patriarchy, who said, well, we don't like emotion, we don't like that, which is why we only think that knowledge lies in books and in speaking and in writing. So in many ways, I think we actually... I think AI, in a strange way, is causing an entire generation, not even generation, just an entire world to rethink what knowledge is. And of course, those people who are very adept at traditional knowledge, who can read, who can write, who can speak in ways that are extroverted and, you know, all of this kind of stuff, like, they don't want to lose that power. So of course, they're going to take different ways of thinking and processing and holding of knowledge as lesser. That's what's happening. And connected to that generationally, I think it is essential that a lot of the this podcast, I want to send it to all of my Gen X and all of my boomer educators and friends. Because quite frankly, we are the ones that do hold the power right now. Right. We are the ones at the top of that hierarchy. And we cannot wait for Gen Z to come up and like break it down, which unfortunately is happening. So, you know, shout out right now to all of my Gen Xers that are listening, to all of my friends that are in generations who are struggling to really grapple with this. It is on us. You cannot walk away.
Right.
I'm just calling y'all out right now. Do not walk away from this, because if you walk away from this, you are doing a disservice not only to your students and to the people, but an entire generation. Okay. There, I said it.
I love that. All right. Mistress, we're just about out of time. I just a couple quick things before we wrap up. What's one thing that you want neurodivergent students and their families to know? Like just one off the top of your head, what's the one thing you would want them to know?
I would want my neurodivergent students to know you are amazing and unique and worthy and valuable and loved. Sometimes it'll seem like the world doesn't, you know, the world doesn't feel that way, but there are avenues for you. I think I would also want to say to them, you have to advocate for yourself, you know, try to find pride in your unique qualities and who you are. And for parents of neurodiverse students and young people, your kids are amazing. Your kids are able. And I would definitely say, you know, give them as much support as you can. And the support isn't always in giving them audiobooks and reading books yourselves. This is what I'd also say to to parents of neurodivergent people. And I know I love books and you just wrote a book, but get your heads out of the books and face your kid and talk to your child and figure out what it is they need and make them feel safe. Because if they feel safe as an individual, then they will be able to navigate that neurodiversity in a much more effective way. It's safety.
Absolutely. And what's one thing that you would want educators and administrators and your professional peers to know?
Too many things.
Give us the Cliff Notes version.
The Cliff Notes version is this is our responsibility. And, you know, I say this with great love and respect for all of the educators that I have ever worked with, those with whom I agree and those with whom I do not agree. But when it comes right down to it, our responsibility as educators is not to teach a subject, it is to teach a child. And doing so requires focus in ways that we might not think. So I'm going to also segue to the administrators. Because administrators, we as teachers and educators can't do this unless we get support, because we're already bleeding out all over our papers. You know what I mean? Like, teachers need better support and better pay, and they need, you know, nervous system regulation. They need all of that support. So administrators also need to provide that. And we can. We can do this. You're already doing it. That's the other thing, is all of the educators I know are already doing these kinds of things in just less focused ways. I don't think that helping our neurodiverse students has to do with, you know, a whole new way of thinking. I think it's just altering what we already do, which is caring about people, helping them to be good, productive, empathetic humans. So we're already doing it. We just have to be a little more focused in the way that we do it.
Great. All right. Well, that's powerful. I love the message. Absolutely wonderful. I'm glad you mentioned all that, because it does sound necessary for people just to realize that it's, you know, we're already doing it. Just kind of open your heart a little bit more.
Exactly.
Okay. So lastly, I mean, just the last thing is, where can people find you and your work? Anything you've been working on lately you want to share, or just how can our audience find you?
I am on LinkedIn. I do have a Substack that I have been writing, called, I've been so excited about talking to you that it's actually escaping my brain right now. It's called Rewriting the Lead, where I talk about all of these particular things and their stories from the classroom and, you know, just about teaching and leadership. The things I'm writing are mostly actually my other creative side, and it's poetry and prose. But mainly, I'm active on LinkedIn and through my Substack. And I would love to have conversations with people about this. Put me on more podcasts. Let me talk to you, because I will talk about this all day, every day, because it's worthy of being exposed.
Well, I'll drop all the contact information in the show notes for anyone who wants to get a hold of you. Okay, so that's it for the interview. I want to thank you so much for being on. First, we're back. The Sight Side is back, season two. Thank you so much for coming on. And this was one of those, we could talk for another 2-3 hours about all of this.
Yeah.
So we'll have to have you back for another episode. For now, that's all we got for today. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. And we'll see you on the next episode of The Sight Side. We'll be right back.